Welcome to JGL Law For You. JGL Law For You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law For You, we will be discussing a wide array of topics to help you navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today, we're talking real estate and divorce, complicated topics that sometimes commingle. And to help us discuss what to do, how to do it, what not to do, is a principal at Joseph Greenwald & Lake, Christopher Castellano, who for over a decade has represented clients in Maryland domestic cases, including custody, divorce, and modification actions. Chris, welcome aboard. Thanks for coming back. And this is a great discussion to have, particularly this time of year, because, you know, we're starting to approach the spring when houses go on the market, when some people are looking to buy houses or move to other homes for school reasons or other. And as you and I know, January and February are busy, busy times for people who are in unhappy relationships. So those two worlds tend to collide, right?
Yeah, absolutely. This time of the year is one of the hottest because you've got a lot of those questions swirling of, you know, what should I do for this upcoming year?
Let's start and work from the top down a little bit. What are the overall concerns, the factors, the things that you want to keep in mind, either those that are real dollars and cents wise or the more intangible emotional type factors?
Right. We're talking just about the house. When you're dealing with a house in the context of dissolving your marriage, there's quite a few things to take into account. You know, first, you have to understand, which is why it's always good to talk to an experienced lawyer, but you have to understand the legal parameters within which you're working, right? And so a house, just like your car, just like your retirement, is an asset, and the court's going to treat it as such. And as a result, you know, we have to look at who owns the house, who's on the title. We have to look at, have either one of the parties contributed to the house, right? If we have a house that's at least partly or entirely premarital, you know, has one person or the other person contributed to the mortgage? There's a lot of different factors that go into the question of ownership of the house and how the court may treat the ownership of the house. And that right there is one of the first core questions that we start to look at.
Let's talk about that. Let's come back to the emotional part, which is often the more difficult thing to deal with. Let's talk about the legal aspect, at least in terms of how Maryland looks at a marital home.
Sure. If you've got a home that you purchased during your marriage with your spouse, it's going to be titled Tenants by the Entirety, and essentially it's owned by both of you equally. The court's going to treat it as such. We're going to 50-50 the house. We're going to sell the house.
When you say 50-50 the house, what does that mean? That means that if the house gets sold, that the two people would split the proceeds equally?
Yeah, that's right. And we're going to look at proceeds as essentially the net proceeds of the house. So we're going to deal with the mortgage. We're going to pay that off. We're going to deal with closing costs. We're going to deal with attorney's fees related to the sale of the house, any taxes necessary. And the net proceeds will get divided 50-50. Now, that could be by way of an agreement or that could be by way of a court order.
Okay. And let's go back to the titling piece, because folks sometimes do things differently. I mean, most of us think we buy a house together, you know, we're both getting on the deed, we're both getting on the mortgage, but that isn't necessarily the case in certain circumstances, right?
Yeah, some people may find it beneficial to have it titled one way or the other. For instance, one spouse, they're on the title just completely by themselves. And for all intent purposes, that may be a sensible decision at the time, right? But of course, that becomes a complicated discussion if now we're on the other end of the equation and we're dissolving the marriage.
Okay. And one of the reasons that folks may, who are married, may buy a piece of property or getting ready to get married, whatever it might be, and have it titled jointly or titled separately, or the mortgage be where there's only one party on there, may have something to do with what? With maybe the credit score of one of the two potential buyers or something like that?
Well, sure. I mean, it may be credit score. In this area, we've got a lot of military, could be various different benefits for different types of loans. There's a lot of factors that go into how the house is titled and how the deed of trust or your mortgage is signaled, but ultimately what the court's going to look at is that marital interest. And that's what I want to focus on next, which is, okay, we've identified the title. We've identified who is essentially living in the home. But how do we look at the value of the house and what portion of that is marital? And that's the next level of discussion.
Let me just ask you a clarifying question for a second. And folks, keep in mind that laws in Maryland are laws in Maryland. Family laws differ from one jurisdiction to another. So as we talk about this, we're talking about Maryland law specifically. But if you live in Virginia or North Carolina or Utah, the laws may be different. So with that parenthetical aside, Chris, let's assume for the purposes of discussion that the property is titled jointly or in what we call tenants by the entireties here in Maryland. Doesn't that mean that it's, quote, marital property as a matter of law?
If it is titled jointly, it is considered under the statute marital property. Yes.
So let's assume that's the case. So then let's talk, continuing your legal analysis for a second. So it's titled jointly, but one of the spouses has some other claim, has some equitable claim, right? Like you mentioned before, that they put more money in to buy it or whatever the case may be. How is that dealt with by the courts, and how do you deal with it in terms of trying to negotiate a resolution on behalf of your client?
Well, it's interesting. The premarital / non-marital contribution to the purchase of a house is always somewhat of a sticky question. I've interacted with judges who have come out in different ways, believe it or not, of that's a gift to the marriage. If you take $50,000 that was acquired and kept separate prior to your marriage, you guys get married, and then 8 months later, you buy a house, and you say, hey, listen, I'm going to take that $50,000 from that premarital account, and I'm going to put it towards the down payment. That's going to be seen as a gift to the marriage, generally speaking.
And so now, you were talking about determining the value of the property. Tell us a little bit more about that. How is that determined exactly?
First and foremost, you could start by estimating the value by just going on Zillow, Redfin, Realtor, whatever it may be. Generally, I look at all those websites, put them on an Excel spreadsheet, and average them, right? There's no clean way to do it. No website's more accurate than the other, but that is a good way to get an estimate. You take that number, whatever you're using, you take that number of the market value, subtract out your loans, your mortgage, your HELOC, etc., a home equity line of credit. And that's your base level net value. Okay. And then the next determination you have to be, and this dovetails from our previous discussion, is are there any other factors playing a part in the value of the house? Is there a prenup, for instance, that says, yeah, that $50,000 I took from that account that I used to put into the down payment of the house, I get that back, right? So if there's any agreement between you and your spouse, whether it's formalized with a large 20-page prenup or if it's a understanding on the back of a napkin signed by both of you, right? All of those are considerations that we have to determine from that net value of the Redfin minus loan, do we take any other items off of that net value?
So people can agree on a value based on an analysis similar to what you just discussed, or they could agree on a value in some other way. That's certainly an option. The other option, though, I guess, is to have a house appraised, right? Is to get a formal appraisal done and to see what the value is.
Yeah, sure. We like to think of these cases that people are going to be amicable, that we're going to be cooperative, and we're going to work together. Oftentimes, as you and I both are well aware, that doesn't usually come to pass, but sometimes it's necessary to involve professionals, right? Real property appraiser. There's levels of amicability between the parties, right? If you're not quite cooperative, but you're not terribly far away from it, people will agree, hey, let's use this well-known real estate agent to do a what they call a drive-by appraisal. And that may satisfy people, right? It may be that you get that appraisal or you use your Redfin and say, you know what, spouse A, I just don't agree with that number at all. I think it's way off. I think it's $100,000 off. Okay. So then we'll talk about getting a professional in, someone who appraises property for a living. And you get that person in and varying different costs, and you can discuss the cost. That's a separate discussion. But you can go and identify a more accurate number that should be attributed to the value of the house.
All right. While you're in this negotiating process,
I'm going to assume that you also discuss with your client sort of the nuclear option. In other words, absent an agreement, you can't work it out. This is what a court will do. We're going to talk about use and possession in a moment. I'm going to come back to that. But let's just talk about we're in a courtroom. We have no agreement as to what's going to happen with the house. Our kids are grown, so we don't have issues of what's use and possession, which again, we're going to dovetail back to in a moment. What will the court do as to that house in those circumstances, assuming there's no agreement, assuming there's a mortgage on the property? What's the nuclear option? What's a court going to do?
Yeah, the baseline, what the court's going to do with a house that's jointly titled, they're going to say, nope, house got to be sold. If there's no kids, house is going to be sold. We're going to net out the mortgage and deal with that at closing. And, you know, everybody gets their share of the net equity of the house. And that's that. And I look at it as almost like a time bomb when I'm negotiating my cases. You know, if there's no kids, let's keep that in mind. If you know that on February 28th, we have trial. And if you can't come to an agreement on what to do with this house or maybe the other assets, you know that the court's going to order that that house is sold. So if you want to do something different, then this is your time to come up with that agreement. So yeah, the nuclear option is, I would consider, the baseline option.
Okay, but it's really worse than that though, right? It's not just that the court orders it sold. The court appoints somebody else to sell it for you, right? A trustee to sell it. And that trustee, in addition to the realtor that the trustee now gets to hire, because you no longer get to make the decisions for your house, right? Now that trustee, not only are you paying a real estate commission picked by the trustee, but you also, what? You pay the trustee a percentage too, right?
That's right. You're paying a hefty percentage to the trustee, who's generally a lawyer in the area, to manage the sale of the house. You lose your authority on repairs necessary to upkeep the house. You lose your authority on, hey, it's springtime. We've got to get a lawn care out. We've got to fix the driveway. We've got to do these things to get this house sold. You know, that person can make those decisions and eats into the available equity of the house. So that nuclear option could end up being quite destructive, if you will, to what you expect to get out of the house.
I assume that it's also a tool for you to use as a motivational factor to try to help get a case resolved.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if the two people are butting heads so significantly that, particularly on the house question, that, listen, if we can't come to terms, then it's going to be a trustee. And usually that brings people to the table, because ultimately, I don't think that there's too many people out there that hate money so much that they want to give it to as many other people as possible. And I think that they come to their senses when they realize, I don't want to give $100,000 to a trustee.
Let's toggle over to, now we do have kids. And what can a court do? And therefore, what discussions do you have with your client relative to the timing of the sale, if there are kids involved, if custody is an issue?
Yeah, so this is where you initially talked about the intangible or the emotional factors of a house sale. Mm-hmm. When you have a case where there's no kids involved, there's a lot less emotions. You know, there may be emotional attachments to the house, but ultimately there's no kids involved. And so the emotional factors are down by quite a bit. Once you have kids, you know, you could throw that out the door. Again, going back to the concept of baseline, what the court's going to do, Maryland, and specific to Maryland only, we have a statute that allows for possession and use of a property up to 3 years. What does that mean? That means that the court can say, all right, the kids need a place to stay. They need a home base. That is the marital home. I'm going to order that the kids can stay up to, it could be any time between this, but up to 3 years within the home. And that means that you're going to have one party or the other that's going to be primarily also in that home.
3 years from what?
The date of the order, right?
The date of divorce, in other words, essentially.
Yeah, okay. Right. And what you've got is all of a sudden the question of what to do with the house in the context of custody also now plays a much greater role, right? Because resolving the house is akin to resolving custody. Because again, whoever is granted, if you will, or, you know, we negotiate for possession and use, ultimately is going to be the primary custodian of the kids within that house.
And I don't want to dig too far down into this topic. And what I'm getting at is nesting. Without talking too much about it, the pluses or minuses. But what about a scenario where the parents agree. The parents have a joint arrangement of some sort that essentially there's a time sharing, whether it's 50-50 or close to it. Have you seen circumstances where folks keep the house for a period of time, the kids stay put, but the parents move in and out? Again, I don't want to talk too much about the utility of that, the pluses and minuses, because you and I could have a whole other discussion about that. But what about something like that? Is that something that's often discussed or worth talking about with your client?
Yeah. And again, this goes back to that idea of, you know, how amicable are the people that you're dealing with, right? And because within the confines of people coming up with an agreement, there's a lot of latitude that Maryland provides, you know, so if you and your spouse are working together and you have kids and you want to come up with a plan that provides stability for your kids relative to the marital home, then you're not really bound to even 3 years, right? You could come up with an agreement where, hey, listen, until the kids graduate from, I don't know, let's say they're very young, they graduate from elementary school, or the youngest graduates from elementary school, whatever it may be, you know, you can come up with a plan or an arrangement that provides for that type of stability.
And I want to talk to you in a moment about the benefits of working on an arrangement to sell the property before the divorce. But let's talk for a minute about ramifications and potential consequences where folks don't. And so I'm going to give you an example and see how we would handle this, how you would handle this. So your client has been in this marital home now for 2 or 3 years, whatever it is. The party separated 2 or 3 years earlier. The kids have lived there with that parent primarily. And now it's time to sell the house. And during that period of time, the parent that you represent has been paying all the expenses at the house, the mortgage, the utilities, the upkeep, and so forth. And now it's time to sell. And the parent who hasn't lived there says, okay, let's sell. But we need to divide everything. We're still going to divide everything equally. In response to that, does your client have any claim to say, no, hold on a second, it shouldn't be equal because of what I've done over the last 2 or 3 years in order to maintain or keep up the property?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are going to have different claims, and you could certainly make a claim that I've contributed to the house out of the separate assets, and maybe I should get a contribution if you're ending up in court, whether the court will agree with that. You know, it depends on the nature of the assets used. There's case law that gets into that. That's probably better left for a grander discussion, but yeah, it depends on whether it's non-marital versus marital. But setting that aside, there's certainly the ability, again, within the context of negotiation, to say, listen, I've paid the mortgage, I've paid the utilities, I've paid the property taxes. So perhaps instead of 50% of the net equity, you know, I should get 55%, 58%, whatever it may be. And again, that's that latitude of negotiation room that you're given in order to come up with what you think is an equitable deal. And if the other person who's been living in the house feels, I've been in the house, I've benefited from the payments, I will agree that, you know, now you can benefit on the back end from greater net equity. Generally speaking, I've certainly seen that and negotiated deals like that.
So you mentioned earlier prenuptial and postnuptial agreements and the potential effect that they may have in terms of dividing proceeds or in terms of what happens with the house. Is it legal for either two people who are about to get married or two people who have been married to enter into a contract that says, in the event of divorce, separation, divorce, this is how we're going to deal with the sale or transfer of this house? Is that something that people can do? And is it something that generally would be enforced by a court?
Yeah, absolutely. That is something that people can do. You know, the house, for most people, the vast majority of people, is their largest asset. And if we all understand at a base level what a prenup and a postnup does, it is to protect someone's interest in assets, right? And this is no different. If you have premarital money before the marriage that you've kept separate that you can contribute to the house and you want a postnup or a prenup, and really a postnup is just the same thing by and large as a prenup just signed after the date of marriage, it allows to protect those assets in the context of an agreement. Yeah, it's certainly allowable. And in a lot of ways, depending on how much you're contributing, is an advisable course of action.
It takes the fight away later if there is. I mean, no one wants to sign one of these things. It's not the most romantic thing in the world, right? But it does take away likely to take away some of the fight that you've been talking about, some of the disadvantages that you've already talked about if they've got an enforceable contract as to what to do with the house, right?
Absolutely. I mean, a prenup is, you know, what I joke is probably the most anticlimactic result you can have to some of these disputes of, hey, listen, the agreement says you get $100,000 back upon sale. And if there's only $120,000 of net equity in the house, just because of whatever reason, it is what it is. The person gets $100,000.
It's hard for people to wrap their hands around it when they're planning weddings or they just got married or whatever the case may be. But it's good to know, and folks ought to hear this out there, that these contracts are, in fact, enforceable. Assuming, right, that they're not written while someone is under the influence of alcohol or written on the back of a napkin while we're having cocktails at the bar or whatever other reasons there may be to nullify any type of a contract, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, prenups and postnups, like a lot of contracts, you have to follow the parameters of a proper contract. But, you know, there's also the very, and this comes up so many times with prenups, and again, a separate discussion, but it bears repeating, is that, you know, a prenup is not something that you want to sign 5 days before the marriage. If you know you're getting married in, let's say, October of 2025, and you're sitting here in February, get on the phone with a lawyer tomorrow. Call that person, because the more distance you have between the signing of a prenup and that marriage, the stronger that prenup is. If you think that you're getting married on February 28th and you're gonna draft and sign a prenup by tomorrow, the 21st of February, you know, that's a good luck type of scenario.
Yeah, I definitely want to have you back and talk about prenuptial and postnuptial agreements, because that does lend itself to a lot of different questions that people would have about them. But staying to topic for just a moment, in terms of the general advantages of resolving what we're going to do with the house prior to the divorce itself, what are we've talked about the disadvantages of waiting, but what are the advantages to folks of getting a house sold prior to the divorce?
Yeah, there's one very, very large benefit, right? And that coincides to the fact that, again, the house is usually the largest asset between two people. And because it's the largest asset, generally speaking, depending on when you bought the house, you know, in this market, if you bought the house last week, you're going to have no equity. But generally speaking, it's going to have a chunk of equity. And that means, for divorce lawyers, liquidity. And that allows people to negotiate in all the other areas of your divorce, because you're going to have retirement benefits, you're going to have investment accounts, bank accounts, and people have their rug collections and antique gun collections. All of these items need to be put on piece of paper, they need to be valued, and you need to come up with a bottom line for each column. Right? For each person, how much do we have and how much can we horse trade? And generally speaking, that house provides the biggest pot from which you could start to trade values. And so if you sell that house and deal with that issue first and foremost, you're setting yourself up for a much cleaner path towards an amicable resolution.
It gives you more information in terms of trying to negotiate a resolution that's fair for both people, right? This shows my age a little bit, but I still tell people that you can't look at marital assets as if they're a photograph, as if they're a snapshot, that you have to look at all of the assets as if they were in a photo album, not that anybody keeps photo albums anymore. But that's kind of a reasonable metaphor, right? You got to look at the whole, all these pictures together, not just one. When you, as someone who's trying to negotiate and represent your client, are trying to get them to a positive result.
Well, that's right. And you can't look at things in isolation. You can't look at your retirement as the one and only pot from which you're going to start to horse trade, because retirement assets are treated different than assets like your house or your investment account or your cryptocurrency or whatever it may be, right? There's different tax consequences. And so you want that freedom of maneuverability that you gain with having the liquidity available on your house. Now, is that question complicated if your house is either underwater? And what I mean by that is, you know, you owe more on the house than the value of the house. Sure, that's going to be a different equation. But again, that's one of those reasons why you sit down with your experienced family law attorney and have that discussion of where are we looking for this house and what should we do with it? And should we offload it sooner rather than later?
That's what I wanted to ask you is, as we get to the end of this episode, what are sort of the key takeaways? What should people really need to do before they list their home, before they make the decision to list their home for sale?
Well, it's a little bit self-serving because I am a family law attorney, as you are. But the number one thing, you know, you're facing down the barrel of a divorce action, a dissolution of your marriage. The first thing you should be doing is setting up a call with an experienced family law attorney. That person who's organized is going to look at all of the assets that you have. He's going to ask you, tell me what the situation with your house is. Let's talk about your bank accounts, your investment accounts, your crypto, all of your assets. And let's identify, does it make sense to put this house on the market? And right now it's February, right? And we are weeks away, not months. We're weeks away from the start of that selling season. Anyone that goes on Redfin or Zillow right now in February is going to see that the inventory is very low. And that housing market is going to heat up. It's going to heat up fast. And so you really need to get in touch with a family law attorney who could start to organize your thoughts, because they've got the experience to say, yeah, this is what we should be looking at. After that, after you come up with that initial plan, your game plan, if you will, for how to move forward, then you can start to look at, all right, based on how amicable or cooperative my spouse is, what are we looking at as far as the value of the house? Should we consider floating values from Redfin and Zillow, or should we go the professional route, meaning hiring a professional to get the value? After that, then we can start to say, is it time to issue an offer to the other side? And that is a buyout of the house, that is a sale of the house, giving dates and parameters, or is that, you know, a closer to a red line arrangement where you say, listen, this is the agreement that we're gonna agree to. Otherwise, we're gonna have a trustee, as we alluded to earlier. It's that where I think timing is key, because if you think that, you know, I'm just gonna put the house on the market in July, you know, the market's hot, it will sell, and I don't want to do anything right now, you can end up losing, depending on the house, $50,000, $75,000, $100,000 on net equity, and that goes a long way in the negotiation process.
Well, this has all been really, really helpful. Again, what we try to do here, and I think you've done a great job of it, Chris, is taking what can be complex legal questions and make them simpler for folks who aren't lawyers, lucky for them, to understand some of these things. And if someone wants to contact you to talk more about what they should do, when they should do it, how they should do it, what's the best way for them to reach you?
Yeah, the best way to reach me is you can call us directly at 240-399-7900. And you can reach me at jgllaw.com, Christopher Castellano. My contact information is listed there as well. And I'd be happy to interact and discuss the concerns of how to deal with a marital home.
Chris, thank you very much for joining us out there, all you folks. Thanks so much for listening in. If you get a chance, hit the subscribe button, subscribe to this podcast. Again, what we try to do here on this show is try to simplify things that are not particularly simple. And again, thanks to Chris so much for doing that today. This is JGL Law for You, and I am David Bullitt, your host.